I'm William O'Flaherty. Welcome to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. You may know me from my two books related to C.S. Lewis, but I'm also the creator of this show as well as its host. In today's episode, I'm talking with Christine Norville about her book, Till We Have Faces, A Reading Companion. While it was first released several years ago, an expanded second edition is new for 2020. Are you familiar with this final novel from Lewis? Even if you're not, be sure to keep listening to learn why you will want to read it and consider getting the book from Christine. Well, welcome to All About Jack, Christine.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, now let's begin with why someone would actually want to read Till We Have Faces. Isn't his best work the Christian apologetic stuff in his Narnia story? So briefly, what's your pitch for this somewhat lesser known book by Lewis?
Yeah, it's interesting. Many of the readers I work with, which is mostly middle school and high school students, they've read Narnia. So they come to Lewis first through his fiction, and then they want to, whenever they find a favorite, they want to keep reading the fiction. And so it's very natural to look up all of the novels that Lewis has written and attempt to read Till We Have Faces. And so what's unique is that so many students, if they try to read it on their own, are really baffled by the setting and the nature and the style of the writing is so very different than the Chronicles of Narnia. And so many students are dissuaded without a little bit of help and a little bit of context to prepare them for what they're actually reading.
Right now, your work is not just a study guide. In fact, your main subtitle is A Reading Companion. And I even noticed inside your book that it says it's, quote, an anyday companion for an everyday reader. For someone who might not get a chance to preview it on a place like Amazon or get a chance to browse the reasonably priced paperback, how would you summarize what you actually do in your book?
Yeah, it's one of those things. I can call it a study guide because it is that. But at the same time, it's a book that's designed where you can read one chapter of Lewis's novel and then read one chapter from my book that includes questions and commentary from other Lewis scholars. And actually, you could read either book first, doesn't matter which one, or read them really just side by side. And that's what a companion piece truly is. My hope was that rather than feeling confused, if you're not in a Lewis course, say in college, or you're not in a discussion setting where you have a classroom and a teacher going back and forth, that you could pick up this book and feel like you are in the conversation and you're listening to, you know, what a teacher would add and other thoughts from other students at the same time, and feel that you're really learning side by side. And it's really intended for any type of reader, not just those who've read a lot of Lewis and know a lot of background, because when I began teaching the book a dozen years ago, more than once, not just students, but the parents of my high school students would tell me, oh, I tried to read that book a long time ago. I never got it. Or I gave up on that book. And I wish I had you in class so I could learn how to read this book. And so many people, just regular everyday readers, like I mentioned, want help, but are also a bit intimidated because they realize there's more than just the story itself. They realize there's more than just the surface level, and they want to understand it, but they give up really fast.
Well, now, many readers often skip over like introductions and or prefaces in books, but I really like what you did in each in your companion. While I'm sure a reader can survive without them, what would you say is the advantage of investing the time to read them?
Isn't that interesting? In classic novels, if you read an introduction, it's by a scholar who's comparing works of an author and opinions and philosophies and giving you all kinds of background and introducing all of the spoilers And with that, most students, most of us as adult readers even, have learned not to read an introduction if we're coming brand new to a book. And my introduction is that, not that. My intent, again, just because my audience, it's designed for people who are new to Lewis and are just jumping in and are trying not to be overwhelmed. It was just to give an opening conversation to assure a new reader that Lewis would want you, he would want you to know the context of when he wrote this, what was going on in his life at the time. He would want you to be aware maybe of a few critical literary theories that influence what he's written and how he's presenting what he's doing. And hopefully, it's just sort of a gentle introduction. It is a little academic, but it's meant to lead you into the book before you begin without giving the spoilers.
Okay. Well, now, you initially released this book a few years ago, but in 2020, when we're actually recording, you came out with what the cover says in an expanded second edition. What is, as they say, new and improved with it?
First off, it is definitely the introduction. I expanded it from just a handful of pages to, I can't even remember how many are in the print copy versus the ebook, but I reached out and got some help this time because I was trying to, without being a scholar myself, I was trying to understand what I might not know enough about Lewis and his writing. And so I reached out to other scholars and got feedback in order to really present an outline that would be fair and accurate and historical and all those good things. So in addition to a much longer introduction, I have added lots of references and footnotes throughout each chapter that give a clear picture and sometimes opposing views of what's happening in a chapter based on the work of other scholars over the last 60 or so years. And this time I also added study questions. I have had over the last couple of years a number of emails, especially from groups, schools, churches overseas that were using my first edition. And they were asking just for regular discussion questions. And more than one email actually said to me, if you were leading this and reading chapter 5 right now with your class, what questions would you ask of us? What would you have said? And I realized, you know what? That was probably missing from the first one. I think I could absolutely add that in and hopefully help any group that's trying to do it on their own.
Well, now, let's pause and consider some of your background. Who is Christine Norville, and how did she become interested in C.S. Lewis?
That's really a very simple answer. I came to Lewis as a reader in elementary school because my older sister and I both exchanged books and checked out plenty of things from our school and city libraries. And once she landed on the Chronicles of Narnia and sped right through them, they went right from her bedroom door to mine. And then we just engaged in a great conversation and just delighted in so many parts of it. And we realized there were so many things we didn't understand, but we just knew we really enjoyed the reading of it. And I did not return to Lewis until much, much later as an adult reader, but also as a teacher trying to create curriculum in a brand new high school. And we were coming up with, in our history, theology, rhetoric, and literature courses, anything related from the ancient times and things that are considered classics. And C.S. Lewis's name came up, and someone mentioned, "Hey, Christine, have you read Till We Have Faces? It's set in an ancient time period, though fictional." And I was like, "Well, I know who C.S. Lewis is. No, I've never read this." And it got added in, and I had never, ever read it before. So right before I began teaching it at the end of freshman ancient literature course, I'm reading it about a month ahead, and I quickly realize I am in too deep and I do not know what I'm reading. And I am researching and asking questions of others who had read Lewis. And at that time, about 12 years ago, there were not that many study materials. Now there's quite a few choices online that really have popped up in the last 3 or 4 years. But at that time, there was almost zero just for the regular reader who's new to Lewis at this level. And so I did a lot of research. I made a lot of mistakes talking with my students and hoping I understood what I was reading. But I also gleaned a lot from the kinds of questions my students would ask me about particular things that were happening in the story. And I knew pretty quickly, once I taught it again the second year, that if I didn't, for instance, introduce my students to the fact that there is a spiritual level, there's a layer that's intertwined with what's happening in the plot, the actual plot. If I didn't say something by chapter 4 or 5 and say, be aware of what Lewis might be doing, there are some spiritual parallels, and let me know if you see something. And as soon as I said something simple and directional like that, all of a sudden my students began talking about types of Christians and maybe a kind of search for faith and what kind of people are looking for what in life and what's this religion that they have in Gloam. And it opened the door very easily. But the first year I taught it when I didn't even know what I was looking for, my students missed it a lot with me. So it's been a learning process. You grow and learn and from each other in a classroom. And that's one of the sweetest places to be. And I just kept taking notes every year I taught it and asking more questions and reading more of what I could find to help me understand it better.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, now I noticed that you have a presence online. So where can people find you and what can they see there?
Sure. I do a lot of nonfiction writing. I suppose you'd call it more academic. So when I published the study guide, the first edition, the reading companion, that is, 4 years ago, I decided to have an author website and do a few uncomfortable things like that. It's not easy to say ChristineNorville.com. it's an odd little choice to make when you launch into that because people can find you. But it became both a teacher blog and a place for dialogue, and just a lot of other things are added on there, including the online high school classes I'm teaching this fall. And there's a little bit of everything. And I do send out a monthly newsletter that includes reading reviews, things that I've read, both academic and teacherly and popular fiction. It talks about the middle grade fiction I'm still learning to write, and just a lot of different interests. So I'm pretty much active on Facebook and Twitter and a lot of the different media that's present.
No, that's great. Well, I hope people will take an opportunity to check your website out. Returning to your companion, Till We Have Faces, you give a blend of summary and commentary, as you noted, before some thought questions for each chapter. Go ahead and give the listeners a sample of what you do.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. Since I already mentioned chapter 4 or 5, I'd like to read just a portion of chapter 4 to you, and it gives a pretty good example of the summary, the condensed summary that's combined with a number of footnotes and some of the parallels to Lewis's other works, especially The Four Loves. So chapter 4, which is a companion to Lewis's chapter 4 in the novel, I titled it Fickle Land, Fickle People. And this is how it begins. Orwell worries about how the people of Gloam will continue to react, fretting about how Unget might be jealous, and about how the priest and other men could retaliate because of the unprompted worship of Psyche. Sure enough, the desperate people return to the palace gates demanding food. The king surprisingly gives in and gives out a portion. When he swears that he cannot do that again because the fields won't bear, several voices in the crowd cry out that it's because the king hasn't had a son. Barren king makes barren land, they say. Immediately, the king signals to an archer to shoot the man who spoke. The man is killed, and the mob flees. But famine has its grip on Glome, even in the palace. Orwal is next leaving work with her father in the pillar room when she encounters Redival and Bada entering the palace. We haven't seen Bada in several chapters, but true to our first impressions of her, she's as critical and deceitful as ever. Redival first saucily exclaims, "You needn't come looking for me, Sister Jailer. When did you last see the little goddess?" Oh, how we hear the dripping sarcasm. Redival and Bada describe how they saw Psyche on her own going through a back lane at the marketplace. Bada mimics Psyche picking up her robes as she steps into a house. Orwal tries to placate Redival and Bada by assuring them that Psyche is just fine since the people were worshipping her a few days before, but Bada seems insistent on talking, or maybe it's rumor mongering. Bada must feel it's her duty to report that the plague is worse and that the people just might be saying Psyche spread the illness with her touch. Maybe Bada wants to feel important. Maybe she's the rumor source. Now, that's just the first portion, but the last two lines, for instance, are thoughts that my students have had. They wondered why Bada was motivated the way she was, and they're like, she wants to feel important. Is she the source of the rumor? These are all normal questions I think a lot of readers encounter. And as the story goes on and Orwal is full of reaction and protection towards Psyche, and Psyche had described what the women in the village had done when they had pulled their skirts away from her as if she were dirty or cursed. And then a group of men and boys jeered at her and threw stones and called her literally the accursed. So Psyche had fled, and she doesn't understand really the nature of the mob mentality. Orwal is in complete reactionary mode through much of the chapter. And when she begins to sound like her own father, Psyche calls Orwal on that and says, "You look just like our father when you say those things." And her comment cuts absolutely, because it is true. Orwal is motivated by an extreme sense of injustice, just in the same manner her father is. And for both of them, it's rooted almost in violence. And one of the unique parallels to Lewis's other works here in The Four Loves is that Lewis explained that all of the loves are susceptible to jealousy, but that affection is most threatened by change. He called it, quote, "the most animal of the loves. Its jealousy is proportionately fierce." And that is an interesting thought to throw in when we talk about how pride might trigger that same jealousy. And Lewis had described in the same chapter in The Four Loves how a family might turn on one member because that person changes and becomes different. If a person becomes a Christian when the family is not, or when a member becomes an intellectual when the family is lowbrow, the family will react. He says it's the reaction to desertion, even to robbery, because someone dared to be different. And that could explain, in the same way, the people's reaction as well as Orwal's. It really is a parallel. So by the end of the chapter, still in chapter 4, when Orwal exclaims to Psyche that you healed them, you blessed these people, you took their filthy disease upon yourself, we know Psyche, out of mercy and even love for the people, was helping them. And then 6 days later, she's accused, and it's absolutely reminiscent of Isaiah's prophecies of Christ. And so naturally within this chapter, I footnote Isaiah 53 verses 3 and 4. Even the wording that is being mimicked by Lewis and how Psyche has become symbolic. But I also add too that many of the scholars are careful to point out that Psyche is not meant to be Christ. She is not a parallel to Christ. Yes, she's of royal birth, and yes, she's considered divine by the people, but she is a type of Christ and something similar but not the same as. And so as the chapter continues and finishes up there, then the two girls have a quiet meal, and it seems like such a quiet ending to that chapter that began in such an exciting way. So my thought questions, as I call them, you could call them study guide questions, practically anything, but I ask my students or any group that happens to be reading this to, number one, reflect on the first paragraph in the chapter. In your own words, write a sentence summarizing Orwell's thoughts, because she is our prime narrator. And my second question is, now that you finished reading the chapter, what is your impression of Orwell now? What has changed since the very first chapter, which isn't that many pages before, honestly? The third one, for example, reads, why does Lewis have the priest return from near death? And what kind of worship or belief might the priest represent? And number four, how are the masks the temple girls wear? A type of veil. And the final question at the end of that chapter is asking about the theme of justice. Like, what is justice to Orwell? What is it to her father, the king? How does jealousy play a part in justice? Or how does pride intertwine with all of these? Just to stir more thought and to analyze and be aware of the types of things that are at play this early in the novel. So that's just one example, one chapter that hopefully brings us to think carefully, to listen well as we read together or read on our own.
Okay, great. Yeah, I think that's a great way to give people a taste of your book. And as I was noting before, and you were commenting earlier about the introduction and preface to set the stage and such, that can really help people gain more from it. And then earlier when you're talking about your interest in Lewis, you kind of parallel or in some regards to what, or you're sensitive to what a new reader to something by Lewis, even if they're familiar with him, how this book is a little bit different. In fact, that leads up to what I was getting ready to ask for a question. That is, Andrew Lazo, in endorsing your book, comments that Till We Have Faces is a, quote, maddening, magnificent novel. Now, let's consider that first word, maddening. How challenging was it for you to come up with material that you wrote?
Well, I've probably explained a little bit of the process, and that was really through time and experience. Continuing to teach it, teaching things really helps you learn, increases your learning curve quickly, and listening to my students, reading, talking to other teachers, my colleagues, in addition to reading a lot more of the scholarly works Until We Have Faces, just so that I would hopefully have a better understanding for myself. And I know Andrew is speaking to the fact that a lot of people come to it and are still bothered by the, as they call it, maybe a pagan framework. You know, why this myth? Why pick something like this that seems so unchristian? And the thing is, there's so much depth, and we know that Lewis appreciated myth in so many ways and writes about it prolifically. But if you're new to Lewis and you're not even aware of what he has said about myth and how myth is this tool and this way to open our eyes to see things differently, just like story is this tool that brings things to life in a different way as we experience it through our minds, through our imagination, it would be a very maddening novel, because you know you're not getting it, but you're just not quite sure why. And there's both the genius of the writing and what it is that is motivating Lewis at this time. And at the same time, it seems like it shouldn't be complicated to the reader who's new to the novel. And yet it can be without a little bit of help along the way.
Well, no, as someone who has written a study guide to another book by Lewis, the Screwtape Letters, the whole process of doing it something is it takes a lot of out of you, even though you do enjoy it. And just like with anything, when you teach, you gain so much more about, learning about what you're teaching than for the first time when they actually are reading it. And so it's a very enjoyable process for the person writing it. So that's good to hear what the process you experienced. Well, now, well, let's see. We're ending up here, Christine. I've enjoyed having you on All About Jack to talk about Till We Have Faces, a reading companion. Let's conclude with having you give a brief final pitch to why the listener will want to consider getting a copy of your book.
Well, I can practically quote a reading group that had emailed me from Japan not too long ago, saying that their church, a group of 15 young ladies, had decided to tackle the book on their own with knowing nothing other than C.S. Lewis's name. And they emailed to tell me that they had to speed up their reading schedule because everyone got so impatient. They felt so encouraged that they were understanding it. They didn't feel lost, they said. And they just reached out to me to let me know that it was such a tremendous help, which is exactly what I had hoped for. They were my niche audience, and I was so happy to hear, especially from another country, that it was a help to them, and they felt that it was for them, asking many deep questions. They felt they knew the questions to ask each other about deeper spiritual things, about redemption, about justice, about how we love and how we don't. And they seemed absolutely delighted with it. And I couldn't be more pleased, because that's exactly my highest hope for it. So I did hear just a few weeks ago that my ebook is now available on most library sites for borrowing. So it is available as a free book, and doesn't necessarily have to be purchased, but it is available at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Kobo, and other ebook retailers. So pretty much worldwide, it is available.
Great. Well, yeah, it's always gratifying to hear what you just explained in terms of the feedback and how people enjoy the work that you've put so much into.
It is.
Well, Christine, thanks again for being on All About Jack.
You are very welcome. I'm so glad we had time to talk today.
Again, I'm William O'Flaherty, your host, and you've been listening to All About Jack, a C.S. Lewis podcast, a feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. Be sure to visit EssentialCSLewis.com for a variety of content, including a series about quotations credited to Lewis that he might not have written. I also have a short YouTube channel entitled 90 Seconds to Knowing C.S. Lewis. There's a link to it in the show notes. Today my guest was Christine Norville, author of Till We Have Faces, a Reading Companion. You'll find a direct link to it in the show notes, as well as a link to her website. Speaking of those notes, you can find them at EssentialCSLewis.com and look for this show. But it might be just as easy to find them where the podcast is hosted, which is All About Jack at podbean.com. Podbean is spelled P-O-D-B-E-A-N. You can also listen to All About Jack via iTunes. See the show notes for a direct link to it there, and consider rating my show on iTunes to help others find it. And of course, please consider sharing this show so others can hear it. Before closing out, in case you didn't know, I've written two books related to C.S. Lewis. Buying them is a great way to indirectly support this podcast, so it can continue to be made freely available. In 2018, The Misquotable C.S. Lewis was published. It explores 75 quotations credited to Lewis. Most are not by him, some are paraphrases, and a few are ones that could be misunderstood without more context. Then in 2016, my first book was released. It's an enhanced study guide to the Screwtape Letters, humorously called C.S. Lewis Goes to Hell. Learn more about it and get a free PDF sample by visiting ScrewtapeCompanion.com. Finally, thank you again for listening to All About Jack, a podcast feature of EssentialCSLewis.com. I'm William O'Flaherty.